Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is October 9th, 2014. Lots of topics to cover tonight. The main science topic, I have a somewhat of an offshoot of a topic, the new ebook called McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project. Has had very good reviews. People that understand what I'm doing here are just, a lot of them are just floored. So this for a lot of people came out of the left field. There was no expectation of this, even though I've been working on this really for an extremely long time in the background, as I have many projects that are going on in the background. But this one, I literally had to just throw it out there because the importance of getting this information out to the public, also to make sure that no one ever would be able to, in a big corporation, be able to take this and somehow patent it out of existence. Patents were designed to promote technology for the benefit of the public. But as with everything in the world today, it's all twisted and backwards for greed. So, at any rate, that's one part of the story. The other one is that I have a topic that is an offshoot. First of all, you have to digest the fact that we can build generators that are derive their energy from the wind, and to separate them from all of the baloney, the garbage that has come in the past regarding wind generation, I call them wing generators. So that's one issue, but you have to grasp the idea that you can build these large enough, they scale up in three dimensions, or a three-dimensional wind generation system, wing generation, excuse me. I just don't like using that word wind because of all of the bad connotations, but the wing generators can be built to supersede the energy production of a nuclear reactor. And so part of it is to get your brain around the idea that we don't have to burn high energy content fuels like coal or nuclear or number two fuel oil or natural gas or whatever it is to create electricity, and we don't need to do that in our automobiles. But let's take this to its logical conclusion. There are already people who are grasping this concept, and it's a natural concept. What if you took a remote community or an island or a place that's just kind of off in the middle of nowhere, a coastal city that's surrounded by mountains that doesn't have any way to get energy generation from a remote source into that site, a site that does, say, desalinization for their water supply, and they do it through, say, for example, reverse osmosis, which is the most common commercial process out there for desalinization. But what if, now I don't want to call this free energy because that has all kinds of bad connotations, all kinds of nutcase stuff all over the internet, free energy. So I don't like using the word free energy because literally nothing is free. Energy does not come out of the middle of nowhere and just fall in your lap. It has to come from somewhere. You have to understand the source. It has to be derived from some source. That's a basic fundamental law of physics, conservation of energy. The energy just doesn't flow into a box that's sitting on the middle of your table. And if it did, you'd have to explain how it got there, not some exotic term that, you know, flash term that somehow magically explain something. No, you have to explain it. You have to have energy transfer from one place to the other, and it has to be reproducible, and it has to be something that anybody can do and observe this, not some pie-in-the-sky idea that if you give me $1 million, I'm going to develop it. No, that's baloney. And so I call this energy independence, which I'd like that term much better. Because imagine a community now. Imagine, oh, let's go off to a little remote community. Let's say up in Maine, off in the coast of Maine. Remote community, depends on fishing and catching lobster and some tourism. But imagine that now that community has offshore wind in abundance. If they put up, and through community effort, put up a wind generation system that floated out on the ocean offshore, not very far, just so far enough so that they got a good line of wind coming in to it, with unobstructed by hills or land around the area. And all of a sudden, the money that they were spending previously on energy for all of their needs, for cars, for heating, for transportation, for manufacturing, for processing their fish, or whatever it is, all of a sudden that's free. That money is no longer going out to energy. It's going out of the community because they don't really have an energy source in their area. They have to import the oil, the fuel, the gasoline, the electricity. It all is being produced somewhere else. Now imagine that community. All of a sudden, everything else stays the same. All of a sudden, that community doesn't have an energy bill. It's basically they paid for the investment. They put up the wing system. All of a sudden, all the money that used to go to energy is in their pockets. Whoa! All of a sudden, other people see that and say, you know, I'm going to put my manufacturing facility there. Those people are good, hardworking people. They're honest. I can build my factory there, pay into there and buy into or expand their wing system, and I'm going to have my energy for free to do my manufacturing, whatever it is. All of a sudden, something changes. Now let's fast forward into the future. I wrote a book a number of years ago called The Diamond Principle. And the whole concept of that, there's many, many, many aspects of this. That's why it's called The Diamond Principle. Because a diamond has many facets and they're organized so that when you look at a diamond or you move it in a light, the facets, the faces that are cut onto the diamond crystal reflect and have internal reflections, etc., and causes this beautiful array of colors and dynamic reflections, and it sparkles and you see it from a distance. The diamond principle is based on that in a society to be brilliant and to function, there are many, many aspects of using coordinating science and engineering and social norms, etc., into a composite where we develop a society that's based on personal responsibility, other things that are unheard of today. Everybody has to obey laws because some idiot over there doesn't know how to, you know, do things right. That's the entire basis of laws of negativity. And then you have people creating terrorist acts so that they can fund their military operation. Just insanity. But, okay, let's fast forward into the future where people are finally developing societies that are capable of going into outer space in mass, in large numbers. Now let's come back to the present day. Simply the little town in Maine that all of a sudden builds their wing generator, become energy independent, and start living a life unattached to the Mideast problems. They say, well, we don't care about the Mideast. We get our own energy here. We don't worry about, you know, the oil that's coming from the Mideast. It's not a problem. We're not going to send our kids into the military because, hey, you know, the oil over there is not a problem. It's not an issue. Okay. Now, that society can begin to develop based on personal responsibility. The money that comes into their area can stay in their area and develop. all of a sudden, guess what's going to happen? No more taxation, because the money that comes in stays there and it works within that community. And so somebody wants to build a house, the guy down the street's the contractor, comes over, builds a house, he gets the money, it comes back in, and the fisherman catches the fish and sells him the fish. And this money is working within that society. It's not going out for energy costs that are raping them blind every week. So at any rate, this is a concept, this is an extension of the wing generator concept, which will produce energy and get us off of this concept of burning high energy content fuels for energy. Okay, with that, I'm going to jump off to a few other topics, few initial topics I want to cover tonight, and then get back to that and break it down and show people. Now, believe me, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. And obviously, people are looking at local communal, community type systems that will provide just their little area. Or maybe somebody's on a farm or a ranch and they moved their family there a decade ago or whatever, and all of a sudden they realize that one of their big expenses is energy. So at any rate, I'll be back to that topic shortly. First, I'm going to interject a few topics here, and then return to this extremely important aspect of energy independence. This week in the news, NASA has decided to look into inflatable space stations. And I remember when I was at Cornell, this is like probably 1979, 1980, somewhere in that time frame, and we were in the NASA scientists, we were in a meeting. These meetings happened almost daily in the space science building, the astronomy space science little building off of the main physics building at Cornell. And the data results from satellites were coming in, and a lot of kind of off-the-cuff discussion happened at those meetings. So it was very interesting to just sit there and listen and watch ideas being passed around. But the subject at hand that day was how to build spacecraft. And so one guy came up with the idea of some kind of a robotic device that built structures, kind of like the Eiffel Tower type of structure, that type of tower, or like the gridwork that's used to build high voltage towers that carry high voltage lines across the country, those gridwork type of towers, and then put a structure on it, some type of a repetition structure, and maybe a geodesic dome type of structure, something that's repetitive, then easily taken apart and put into a space capsule. And the idea is that instead of sending up this entirely built unit, that you build a, send up pieces and build it up in outer space, and therefore you get a much bigger end product. Of course, it all has to be delivered by rocket technology, the heavy lift rockets to get the parts up to space. And currently, only the International Space Station has been built with canisters that go up in a single piece. They assemble them, and it's quite an assemblage at this time, the International Space Station. But now they're looking into inflatable space stations, and it's something that I had thought about at the time. I thought, you build the Goodyear blimp, and that would very well serve in outer space. And look at how big that is, and when you take one of those Goodyear blimps and break it down, fold it up, you put it in a box, so to speak, it doesn't take up much room at all. So at any rate, they're looking into that, and that's a good idea. If you look once again, I mentioned earlier my Diamond Principle book. In the Diamond Principle book, I talk about building space stations, the construction of space station based on tubes. And these tubes would be put into space individually, full of air, ready to go, because the air doesn't weigh that much, and possibly some water also. But these are big tubes. We're talking maybe 90 feet in diameter and, you know, 400 feet long tubes. Putting those up into space, have a manufacturing plant on Earth, and then when they get up there, you bundle these together, and then you hook them together end to end, and overall, when you get done, you have a kind of like a 2001 Space Odyssey space station made up of all these tubes. That solves the micrometeorite problem of these high-energy, high-velocity micrometeorites, because if one of these tubes ever got damaged, well, the people would have time. You'd have like a self-patching type of system in there, because the air is going to be going out of a small hole where all of a sudden these patches fly up and plug that hole temporarily. And if it's a big hole, well, then you got a minute to get the people out of there or whatever, and get them into one of the adjacent tubes. So it's a redundancy, built-in redundancy, so to speak. But anyway, you can read about that in my book, The Diamond Principle, as the method of going into outer space, and then also the electromagnetic propulsion systems is a big part of that, not using chemical rockets. Another story in the news, Bill Gates Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, being sued in India. Now, these people have been behind vaccination testing programs around the world, and they're using poor kids in these third world countries, in this case India, to test all kinds of vaccines. Anyway, you have to... I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I'm just telling you this because you can go look this up on the internet and read about the horrific results with these poor kids in countries where they've been given vaccinations, getting sick, hundreds of them being sick and being taken off and then brought back, and you know, absolutely no care, no follow-up, no regard for the well-being of these kids are being used for pharmaceutical testing. Anyway, check that out. Bill Gates, Melinda Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. What's interesting to see the entire laundry list of foundations and organizations that are behind this. It's pretty scary stuff. But at any rate, this past week, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded to scientists, and of course all these advancements are wonderful. That was for a very efficient blue LED, which got them the Nobel Prize. But I see this more as an engineering advancement. The LEDs have been around. If that was the first LED light to be built, I could see possibly that would, but an advancement, a tweak on an existing technology, is something that you would, you know, that's an engineering advancement. It's not a critical turnkey discovery that changes the course of the world. So there's a big difference. And I'm not saying that this blue, very efficient LED diode is not important. Of course it's important. It's a major contribution to advancement of low energy light. Many people don't understand the old incandescent light bulbs. About 95% of the energy expended in that light bulb went off in the form of heat, a lot of infrared, and only a small portion was in the form of visible light. So very expensive in terms of electricity, and so now it's great that people are going to other forms of lighting, low energy lighting, and that's of course in our energy equation in the Western world, about a third of the energy consumption is for lighting. So if we could knock that way down, it would be super. But the Nobel Prize in recent years has been a bit strange at best, and it's hard to figure out. They gave it a couple years ago. I was really incensed for a Nobel Prize for the, I believe it was the COBE satellite, that maybe data that was decades old and really had a lot of problems with it, but they gave it for confirmation, essentially confirmation of the Big Bang Theory, something that really never happened. In physics, there are other explanations. There is so much contradictory data regarding the basis for the Big Bang Theory, not the least of which there are good alternate, there's a good alternative explanation for the redshift that comes from quasars. And Halton Arp, a guy I communicated with earlier in my career before he died, had, and a guy named Bainbridge, had vast amounts of data showing that quasars were associated with normal galaxies and that they were connected by strings, and not only in the visible spectrum, but also in other portions of the electromagnetic spectrum, all the way up to X-rays, all the way down to microwaves and infrared radiation, connecting these in strings. And what I showed is that the quasars were in fact a comet phenomenon with the charging of the quasar nucleus in the non-uniform electric field around the fusion core of the galaxy, the same property that charges up comet nuclei, and that the redshift was in fact something I called in my early work I discovered when I was at Cornell, I called it the induced electric dipole redshift, which is verifiable in the laboratory. So to give a Nobel Prize on very weak, outdated data was very questionable. It was a political move, and it was something that was heralded by the astrophysics, the astronomy community, that really it was more like a religion than a science. But anyway, I really don't agree with the Nobel Prize this year. I think there are things that are much more important. The discoveries, actually I probably got a few that I would put ahead of that myself, but I don't want to sit here blowing my own horn or beating my own drum, so to speak, but there are more important advancements in the world of physics than an advancement with a light, an LED light. But and once again, I'm not trying to downgrade that discovery. I think it's a tremendous discovery. I think it has extreme value. But in terms of what the Nobel Prize represents, it is a concept. It is a key turning point that opens up a new vista, a new direction, a new understanding, basic fundamental understanding that is the basis for the Nobel Prize. Anyway, enough of that. This week, the Rosetta mission, it just keeps getting stranger and stranger. The Rosetta spacecraft, European Space Agency spacecraft, orbiting a comet nucleus, now zoning in within 30 kilometers of the nucleus, planning a landing to land on the comet nucleus around the 11th of November, I believe is the date. And I thought that they were going to have a probe that went down really a long ways into this comet nucleus, something that, where they had to attach somehow to the comet nucleus with probably screws, some type of screw, just like a rock climber attaches onto the rock face that he's climbing with a screw type of device. And then with that, holding on, because there's not enough gravity within the nucleus of the comet because it's so small, that then they could take a probe and drill, you know, a few hundred feet possibly down into the core of this comet nucleus. But no, it's a scant, I think it's like less than a centimeter. I'm going, you can't be serious. You designed a spacecraft, 10 years to get there, all the money and everything and all the teams of scientists, and you want to find out what's inside this comet nucleus. and you can go down a centimeter? Come on, buddy. What are these people doing? What are they smoking over there? But the clincher is here that they released a photo. It was taken on September 26th by the orbiting spacecraft, and it showed some ray-like activity coming off the nucleus. And Discover News, which I understand is a branch of Discover Magazine, that's my understanding, put out an article, and of course this may have been reproduced elsewhere. What I saw came from Discover News. But there was this obviously very heavy photoshopping in this photo. The nucleus looked relatively white in the picture, but the European Space Agency own report and also all reports from all other comets that we visited indicate that the comet nucleus is the blackest thing, blacker than charcoal that you put in your barbecue. It's the blackest black that exists in the solar system as on the nucleus of a comet. The same thing with Halley's nucleus, Halley's comet nucleus, and all of the other. Pure black. So obviously a lot of photoshopping going on to make this nucleus look white. And then this faint ray of material coming off, which they claim is dust and sand. And then the article just says that this is due to sublimation of gases and dust, gases and water that are in the nucleus, somehow implying that this is what creates the comet tail, the dirty snowball comet model, which is bogus, of course. And the real situation, this is a result of the electron beam, the sunward electron beam in the plasma discharge, in my comet model, the plasma discharge comet model. The sunward, the electron beam that comes from the sun, which is part of the electrical discharge, is starting to concentrate sufficiently to where it's hitting the nucleus. And it's very interesting how it etches out the central part of this, and the ray was coming out of the central part of the nucleus. But the question is, how do they somehow justify this little ray that happened on only September 26th as somehow creating the comet tail? Because the comet tail has been there literally for years. This comet has had a comet tail and is very soft and faint and symmetrical, perfectly stable. It does not vary other than slightly in shape and size, but it's very smooth, even coma around the comet nucleus. How do they translate this little one-time, one-day ray of material coming off the comet nucleus into this broad, very symmetrical, very even comet tail? It's absurd. But that's what they do in this article. They never said Icy Wander or Dirty Snowball Comet Model, in it just implying that this is sublimation of gases and ice. But now it gets a little stickier here, because the European Space Agency on its Rosetta spacecraft has spectrometers and very sensitive equipment that has the ability to measure gases and volatiles coming off the comet nucleus. But they don't measure any. They don't report any at all. And this is noted in the blog on the article that I said one of the scientists, obviously a scientist, is saying, hey, you have equipment there that would indicate you're saying this is due to volatiles, due to sublimation of volatiles coming off the nucleus, but you don't report any. That should be measured by this spacecraft. So the very coy reporting, and of course it's done through Discover Magazine, not a scientific journal release, as one might expect it should be. But a lot of funny work going on regarding comets. NASA, of course, is preparing in about 10 days, actually, from tonight, October 19th, the closest approach of comet sighting spring to Mars. And here, once again, strange naming of this comet. Why is it named after the telescope facility that discovered it when Robert McNaught, a very prolific comet finder, a person that looks for and finds comets from Australia, I believe he's from Australia, or at least works there, discovered the comet, and he has many, many, many comets named after him, Comet McNaught, whatever. You know, his name is attached to many comets, but not to this one. Remember that the other comets, I made comments on my show many other times, that they were discovered by Russian scientists, and they named the comets after the observatory, not after the scientists who discovered, even though all previous discoveries of comets were attributed to the scientists, not the facility. But at any rate, comet sighting spring, and unfortunately, this Mars is going to be, I believe, in the evening sky, and really not visible from our vantage point at Earth. I don't believe we're going to have a good sky vista of this comet. And so, and as being as faint as it is and next to Mars, I don't think it's a good opportunity for amateurs to see this activity, which is unfortunate. But remember, it's a relatively small comet. It has a coma, the cloud around the nucleus, 19,000 miles in diameter, which is big enough to possibly see with the naked eye if it were bright enough. But the thing is, with it passing by Mars, there could be observations of electrical activity once this sparks on the connects to Mars. There could be activity in the Martian atmosphere. NASA and India, of all countries, has a spacecraft up there. NASA, I think, has five total, possibly five with India. We have the Mars Observatory, or the Mars Observer satellite, which is in orbit. You have the MAVEN mission, which just arrived, got there in 10 months, record time, from NASA, with two satellites. The MOM mission from India, M-O-M, which is there to study supposedly the Martian atmosphere, etc. But all of this activity, plus two Martian landers, I think Odyssey and the, I forget the names of the Martian landers, the rovers that are on, all of these are going to observe this cometary activity. And, of course, my prediction is very clear. There should be electrical activity. There should be aurora activity. The comet tail actually should jump to Mars, because Mars will, once the comet is coming in, the comet will have a much higher potential because it's coming on an elliptical orbit. It's discharging the solar capacitor much more than Mars, which is in a circular, relatively circular orbit around the Sun. So there's once Mars gets into the shielding, the hydrogen, ionized hydrogen shielding around the comet, which extends far out beyond their interaction zone, there should be electrical discharging between the comet and Mars, which could reach all the way, in fact, it should reach all the way down to the surface of Mars. So all of this observable and lightning effects, auroras, upper atmospheric, probably what we call luminescent clouds or noctoluminescent clouds visible on Mars, all of this activity should be visible and recorded. The question is, what's NASA going to report? And of course, if they do report anything, it'll be totally clouded and misguided. It's like I announced last week, it's very odd that the news conference that NASA is presenting for all of this is going to occur like this next week before the encounter. There's nothing live going on as far as news media being in the studio, so to speak, with NASA during the actual crossing. So NASA will have free rein to doctor the data and release what they want, and we've seen this before many years ago. It was July 4th. What year was it? Was it? It was 2005, I believe. July 4th, I was an invited guest on the Coast to Coast AM radio show, and we were waiting for the results of the Comet Temple 1 deep impact mission when the probe was being sent into the comet nucleus. And it was 6 months later when NASA very begrudgingly released data and had it completely doctored before they released the data to try and protect their dirty snowball comet model. Anyway, we'll have more on that next week as this develops, but I'm not expecting anything in the way of honest reporting here. Speaking of honest reporting, there's a question as to whether the election in Scotland this past week was rigged. And, of course, for England to lose Scotland would be a major kick somewhere because it's been part of England forever. You know, going way back to the early kings and the Celts, etc. But the issue is that there's a lot of question as to whether the election was fixed. Just two other quick topics here. There was an article someone sent me. It's called Lightning Out of the Blue. And it's a phenomena that occurs actually quite frequently, although in terms of actual physical, the physics community which studies lightning, this was a rare event because they actually captured it on camera. And they don't understand lightning, let alone lightning out of a blue sky. In my, which book is it? I think it's the Atlanta to Tesla, the Colburn Connection, or possibly it's the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. I think that's the book that it's in. I show a picture of a tornado that's coming out of Mount Etna, as I recall, in the book. But it's a color photo, and you can see the lightning inside the tornado just reaching out the top of this volcanic caldera on a clear blue sky. And this is very common. You see a lot of lightning activity above the calderas of volcanoes, especially active volcanoes. In my poster, my colorful poster, I show a picture of one of the Chilean volcanoes with extreme amount of lightning branching out of the plume, the ash plume above the volcano. And in my Atlantis to Tesla Colburn Connection book is a picture of the of a volcano in the South China Sea, one of the more electrical active places on the planet, and historically electrically active. By the way, that's where Atlanta lay, is in the South China Sea. And the book explains why that's the case. Due to research of a physicist from South America, very excellent work. And I enumerate on that in the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. But the point is, volcanic lightning above volcanic calderas, and the picture is taken at night. But what the point is that atmospheric lightning, when the Russians discovered my work back in the mid-90s, they started translating my work into Russian, started communicating, having meetings, they were studying these atmospheric electrical phenomena, and they had no idea what was causing it, where it came from. When they discovered my work, all of a sudden the light went on, to make a story short. They discovered and they realized that I was right about the source of electricity, atmospheric electricity, which really originated in outer space. So that's just another twist on this story. So the understanding of lightning and where it comes from has been known about for a long time, except in the Western university world, they're still wallowing in complete ignorance, believing that lightning is caused by tumultuous activity, air current drafts in a cloud. But even if it were, which it is not, the charge activity would soon move out to the outside of the cloud, because that's what charges do in a conducting body. They move to the outer edge, and they would soon be neutralized, because overall the cloud is neutral. And inside the cloud, you would have the green function integral would show that you have basically a zero field inside. So at any rate, basic physics. But these people who study lightning have no clue what is going on here. And that's just another good example. Another issue on electricity, and I'll get back to the main science topic, but this is a good topic. Everybody should go visit this web page. It's called dirtyelectricity.com, I believe is the web page. But it talks about the true cost, the expense, and the pollution. In this case, the EMF pollution that comes out of electric power lines and the electricity that's in the houses, it's everywhere. The book, there's a book that's out by that name also, but which, by the way, I have not read myself at this point, but I can see enough by the webpage that the topic is right on point, that dirty electricity, the real cost of electricity being everywhere. And may I remind you that my webpage, jmccsci.com, I have the full line of water filter products. The new GF filters take out chloramines and pharmaceuticals and lead and heavy metal, fluoride, arsenic, all in the filter. And I want to remind you, too, that my little mini travel filters, these have been very popular. And I use them myself. I do a bit of traveling with my work. And I always, as they say, I don't leave home without it. The little filters, the little 5-inch filters, which go in the travel emergency sports filter, and that's not just for travel, it's for sports, etc. And it comes with extra bottles that are capped, so you can store your water once you filter it and carry it with you. That is the same GF filter technology that are in the big filters. So at any rate, visit the webpage. I'm not going to talk a lot about that. All the information is on the webpage, jmccsci.com. And I just want to remind people that I pay for this airtime myself. If no money comes in, I still pay for it. This is what I do. But your support on the sales page helps to support this program in a commercial-free venue. I never will have commercials. I never have had commercials. And just allows me complete freedom to talk about whatever I want to talk about and bring you real information. In this world of misinformation, internet, and misinformation from Google and Wikipedia and places that are now completely controlled information sources, finding real information is getting harder and harder every day. My new book called McCanny Wing Generator, of course, hit the streets a number of weeks ago, and the response has been excellent. Let me just put it that way. The concept that you can build an efficient generator based on the capturing of energy from the wind is something that people just never expected. Now, I worked in the background trying to get this up and off the ground and running, but every time I did, the financiers would disappear into the woodwork, and you can imagine possibly why. And they literally disappeared. I've never heard from them since or heard of them since. So at any rate, that's neither here nor there. So what I decided to do was make a public release of this information on a open architecture and licensing basis. The response to this has been tremendous. And so and I know there's people listening there that are just, they're still waiting for me to get back to them. I will accomplish all of that shortly in short order. But some people I'm already dealing with. It just I'm one person, and but the one thing I want to stress is that I want the small developer, the small person, or the person with a home system that has the capability of putting these together, to develop them. But remember, you have to be savvy about this kind of equipment. I don't give designs where it's like put part A into part B and get part C. No, that's you need to understand these systems. Wind is dangerous. Electricity is dangerous. Converting electricity from DC to AC. I knew a guy that was going to use some like cabling from a light cord to wire up a 12-volt system, and you need heavy-duty cables, something like an inch in diameter, to run the heavy currents that come out of a low-voltage DC system to convert it up to running higher voltage, significant power systems. And so, really, unless you know what you're doing, don't even go near this, because you're going to make mistakes and you could kill yourself or somebody else. But the people who do have savvy in these areas have no problem building, constructing, and moving forward with real research in this area. And so the licensing is available. But tonight my main science topic is dealing with energy self-sufficient communities. I already talked about earlier in the show about the Diamond Principle. And by the way, the Diamond Principle is required reading for all kids. That's available both in print form and ebook form on my webpage. And by the way, when I was talking about the water filter systems on my webpage, my entire library of books, CDs, and DVDs are there also. Most of the books are in ebook format. The only one that is not is the Calculate Primes book. And that's because it is just too complicated the way it's put together to be printed. And then it comes with a 3-hour lecture DVD, which is just not available in e-format. There's no way to download or conveniently put that on a server. You know, it just can't happen. So the Calculate Primes book will never be in an e-book format. But all the other books are available in e-format or print form also. And the Diamond Principle book is required reading for all kids. I mean, you got to read this, kids. It's part of your growing up process. Just like reading any great literature that you might read in school, the Diamond Principle at my webpage is absolute required reading. And parents, you have to get this book and make your kids sit down and read it end to end. Then they will begin to understand a bit about how the world really spins. I mentioned earlier that the ability to self-sufficient energy, now remember, I don't call this free energy. Free energy is a misnomer. It's been so abused and misused, kind of like wind generator, wind with a D, that I had to get away from it. So I'm talking about energy self-sufficiency using the wind generator technology, where you can efficiently extract energy from slower moving winds. And that was one of the big points when I was developing these systems. One of the biggest points was, how do you extract a good quantity of energy from a slow-moving the wind, when the wind is not 30 miles per hour? When it's at 25 or 20 or 15 or even 10 miles an hour, you still can extract a significant amount of energy. How do you do that? And so, anyway, that's one of the main points of the wind generation system, is its efficiency at low wind speeds. Okay, so now you can size a system, and of course, all of this is engineering. It's something that I have experience with because I've been working with systems like this for a long time. But some people write in, they say, is there an equation or is there a formula to understand what kind of energy I'm going to get out of such a size system, etc. And it's very, very complicated. The wing systems grow in three dimensions. By contrast, the three-blade wind generator systems that you see sprinkled around the countryside grow in two dimensions. So they're really not, there's no comparison with what has been done with what I've done. There are many other factors. Your ability to build a system that adjusts optimally to changing wind conditions, there are so many factors. It may be like many aerodynamic systems, the system might be more efficient at 15 mile an hour wind speed than it is at 20. And this is going to vary from design to design. Like I say, these scale up in three dimensions, the third dimension being the depth of the wings. And so there's people who understand aerodynamics and the lift on, say, airplane wings or slow-moving airplane wings, or the dynamics, the engineering is difficult in the way all of this was done, like, say, with airplanes, was that they simply gained experience over the years and building one and some wind tunnel testing. But ultimately, you have to build the full-size model, get it out there, get it working, tweak it, change things, and then you're going to get an idea of what kind of relative efficiencies you're going to get, and it's called an efficiency curve. But it really is not indicative of a lot of things. Now, with a large, say, 1,000-foot-tall wing generator, imagine the difference in wind vector at the top of this thing, 1,000 feet up in the air, and the wind vector down at the bottom. The system is beautifully designed so that no matter how much wind is available in what its vector, its direction and velocity, the wings work independently so that the energy developed, the force developed to move the giant wheel, so to speak, is always optimal for the amount of wind that's available. And they never work against each other. They always work for each other because they're indelibly hooked together in this big structure. So if you're getting a little bit of force at the bottom and a lot of force at the top, it doesn't matter. They are both going to equally do their job and contribute as much as they can. You can imagine it like this. Remember the old, it's like a series of poles that come out of a pulley system on a big ship. And the men walked around in circles and the chain wrapped around the post. And that's how they brought the anchor up. Say one guy is not exactly as strong as one of the big hefty guys pulling up the anchor. Well, the big guy can push as hard as he wants, and the little guy can push as hard as he wants, and all of them are contributing to their ability to make the anchor come up. So you don't have to have it evenly balanced. I always got a kick out of the movie Ben-Hur, where they were sizing up the horses for the chariot race, and the guy who was running the chariots couldn't get the horses to turn the corner, and good old Ben came up and he goes, "Hey, you got the wrong horse in the wrong spot here." So they switch them around, and then all the horses run perfectly. But that's not the case with a wing generator. The wing generator, the wings do the work to their ability, and all of them contribute to their ability. So when that wing that's up at the top swings around and finally gets to the bottom, it's going to be doing less work than it did when it was at the top. One of the big problems with the three-blade wind generators is that their airfoils don't point in the direction of spin. So the work they're doing is to create torque on the central shaft that is working not in the direction of rotation, but against 90 degrees to the direction of rotation. So what they do when the one big blade is up at the top, the other two blades are coming out at 60-degree angles from the bottom. There's nothing to balance that big blade up at the top, so it's being wrenched backwards towards the post, and there's nothing down at the bottom to counterbalance it. So as these blades swing up, they're being whipped back and forth. So most of the design effort is to try and manage this unwieldy long blade that's whipping back and forth in the wrong direction. It's absolutely absurd. So at any rate, the one thing my wing generators do is the whole design, the whole concept is absolutely totally different. And the feedback that I've gotten, for example, all of the heavy equipment is at the ground level, not up, 300 feet up in the air. You can build these from a single vertical platform, and you don't need cranes. I mean, the amount of engineering, it's one, like when you buy a car and you go to get it fixed, and the guy goes, well, you need this part replaced, but you got to take the whole motor out and the motor mounts to get to it. And it's like, didn't the guy that designed this ever think about the guy that had to repair it? And the answer is no. The guy that designed it, just this is how they all go together, and you put the motor in, you bolt it together. Never a thought as to, well, maybe in some cases, but rarely a thought as to how you're going to fix this thing. How are you going to get it, that one little teeny part down there, without taking the whole motor apart? So anyway, what I did is I engineered a product, a design that allows for easy assembly, easy maintenance. All the heavy equipment is at the ground. All of the structure is very lightweight and very easily maintained. All of these properties that are bad with the old three-blade wind generators, I have changed. Like the old three-blade wind generators killed animals, killed birds, because they're spinning around, the bird's trying to fly through, and all of a sudden, whack, they get hit with this blade coming out of the blue. The wing generators don't spin fast. They spin slowly. It's just like there's so many opposites in the wing generator versus the old wind. That's why I had to develop a new word calling them wing generators, because there's just no comparison. It looks like I'm running out of time here. I just want to remind you that, well, the main topic tonight was self-sufficient communities, and it doesn't take too much to imagine what would happen if you had no energy bills anymore. But remember, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, more information there, and get the book, McCanny Wing Generator. It's an education also in the energy industry, which is totally distorted these days. Once again, it's Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.